Good morning. Welcome to our Sunday school time. This morning, Lauren Patches Keller is going to be speaking to us. She is part of Thrive Counseling Service. Are you at Ephrata Community Church? You're actually in their building. Okay, they're in Ephrata Community Church. So will you join me in prayer as we start our time together this morning? Lord, we just thank you for this day that you've given us. Thank you for the sunshine. And just thank you for the rain that is coming that will water the earth. I just pray that you will speak to our hearts and minds this morning as Lauren leads us during this time. And I just pray that you'll be with Mike as he leads us in our worship service later on. Just open our hearts and minds to what you have for us today. In Jesus' name, amen.
So, yeah, Mike Wanger and I are really privileged to be here today. Thank you for coming and listening. And hopefully this will be, it's probably going to be a little bit more informational for you. We have been here before, but what were our goal here today, or what we were kind of asked, is just to kind of give you a little bit of like a taste or some information or on like, hey, like how do you spot some mental health if like you're struggling? But we also want to help. So we're going to go over some anxiety, depression and things, but we really do want you guys, where we share this information, because we want you guys to also kind of like normalize it a little bit, that we all struggle at some points in our life, or maybe for periods of our life, with some level of maybe anxiety or depression. And that's usually because we're human and God created us with emotions and mood. And so we just wanted to bring some awareness to that, kind of give you guys information about that. And then Mike will be sharing on a different topic during the church service. So we'll go over this video. It's a short clip, probably about like around three minutes. And then we'll talk about emotional first aid.
Just my luck.
I grew up with my identical twin, who was an incredibly loving brother. Now, one thing about being a twin is it makes you an expert at spotting favoritism. If his cookie was even slightly bigger than my cookie, I had questions. And clearly, I wasn't starving. When I became a psychologist, I began to notice favoritism of a different kind, and that is how much more we value the body than we do the mind. I spent 9 years at university earning my doctorate in psychology, and I can't tell you how many people look at my business card and say, oh, a psychologist, so not a real doctor. As if it should say that on my card. This favoritism, we show the body over the mind. I see it everywhere. I recently was at a friend's house and their 5-year-old was getting ready for bed. He was standing on a stool by the sink, brushing his teeth, when he slipped and scratched his leg on the stool when he fell. He cried for a minute, but then he got back up, got back on the stool, and reached out for a box of Band-Aids to put one on his cut. Now, this kid could barely tie his shoelaces, but he knew you have to cover a cut so it doesn't become infected, and you have to care for your teeth by brushing twice a day. We all know how to maintain our physical health and how to practice dental hygiene, right? We know it since we were 5 years old. But what do we know about maintaining our psychological health? Well, nothing. What do we teach our children about emotional hygiene? Nothing. How is it we spend more time taking care of our teeth than we do our minds? Why is it our physical health is so much more important to us than our psychological health? You know, we sustain psychological injuries even more often than we do physical ones, injuries like failure or rejection or loneliness. And they can also get worse if we ignore them, and they can impact our lives in dramatic ways. And yet, even though there are scientifically proven techniques we could use to treat these kinds of psychological injuries, we don't. It doesn't even occur to us that we should. Oh, you're feeling depressed. Just shake it off. It's all in your head. Can you imagine saying that to somebody with a broken leg? Oh, just walk it off. It's all in your leg. It is time we close the gap between our physical and our psychological health. It's time we made them more equal.
I really love that. It's funny. He just really kind of puts things in perspective, right? And it's true. We do put a lot of knowledge, and we grow up knowing a lot about physical health and how we take care of those scrapes and bruises and things. But we don't often get a whole lot of help or assistance or knowledge or education as parents or as other individuals of like, hey, how do we take care of our hearts and our emotions and our mind? And it's true, we all go through a lot, each and every day, but even through our lifetime of just having different wounds. And so a lot of times what we may look for as counselors is like, hey, if someone is really struggling with anxiety or depression or something else or trauma, right? It's usually a whole bunch of different experiences that they've had that have usually kind of built up into something where they're beginning to believe in a negative belief about themselves. Right? That if it happens enough, it seems to be reinforced. And then we begin to think, oh, well, this must be true of me. Or we begin to have this fear, like over time, right? If something keeps happening or different things happen, we begin to believe, oh, maybe it is possible for this negative thing to happen. And anyway, so there's a whole bunch of different factors that we look at. But there's usually things that happen over time that maybe we haven't taken care of, or we don't know how to kind of bring healing or some kind of emotional or psychological first aid to. Some things we may not go over everything, but there are some things that maybe we'll talk about with that.
Please forgive me if I'm sit and stand. I'm dealing with significant back pain right now. And so if I yell out, just say, amen, right? I told Tony to do that. That way it won't look so foolish. But I feel like it's going to be awkward if you see me sitting and standing. I'm just dealing with some health stuff. But one of the things I wanted to add to that, just the thought of just get over it. If you have my back, walk it off. Rub a little dirt on it. Just move, you know. It'll be fine. Keep moving. Well, it's really hard to do that when you're in a significant amount of pain. Years ago, when I dealt with anxiety, with anxiety, I had a lot of people that didn't know what to do with that. And so well-meaning Christian people were saying to me, you need to pray. You just need to pray about it. Oh, that's what I should do? Didn't even think about that. You know, like that was something I was doing all the time, asking God, please take this fear away, take this feelings away, right? The other thing is people would say, you need to read your Bible, get in the scripture. Here's a verse on fear and, you know, those types of things. Oh, okay. And all these things made me feel, Well, let me say this one, too. Someone said, well, you have this six-month-old daughter. You need to be focusing on her and your wife and less on yourself. What do you think those comments actually did for me? Did they make me feel better or did they make me feel full of shame? Full of shame. And it drove me, not only here was I anxious, now I was depressed. Because I thought, here I am, this horrible father, horrible Christian, you know, and it wasn't until I understood the deeper reasons of why the anxiety was coming up for me and working through that, that it actually became better for me. Tracking back, I found out that MS, which is what I have, a precursor to an MS attack can be a panic attack. So the anxiety and MS are kind of linked together. So it was interesting because my first panic attack, all of a sudden I went numb from here down in my arm. And that was back in my early 20s. And my neurologist now says that was probably your first MS attack. So it wasn't just a spiritual thing. It was biological, it was psychological. There's a lot of things going on in that. So we have to be careful that we have compassion over for these people as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Mike. It is important, and we recognize that it's not just a quick fix all the time, and that sometimes it is really helpful to go to a counselor or get some kind of professional help to kind of assist with, like, hey, what's underneath? What are some of those roots? And how do we heal those places of our hearts, of our emotions, in our mind? Mental health is defined as a state of well-being in which every individual realizes his or her potential, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make a contribution to his or her community. So pretty much that's right. Just being able to function and contribute and do those normal things that we need to do or we like to do or enjoy in life. Mental illness, right, is just kind of the opposite of just thinking, hey, there's changes in how I'm thinking or what I'm thinking or how I'm functioning. And there's usually some kind of distress where I'm not able to really do things well or as well as I used to or normally do, and really struggling to function well. So for like a teen or an adult, right, maybe that's like it's a struggle to get up in the morning and really like there's so much anxiety, it's hard to even go to school or to work or to be able to function well at school or work because we're just so in our head or we're so anxious. Or maybe we're feeling really depressed, and so it's really hard to even be motivated. It's really hard to, like, it's just you're dreading everything, and you just really have low mood, you're sad, and we'll go over some of the depression, right? But it's hard where you're so depressed, it's hard to even interact with anyone or even want to interact with anyone, and we just maybe isolate. So usually when we say, like, hey, like, mental illness, it sounds really bad. And it's kind of like they're ill. But really what we're just saying, right, is that, hey, there's like an emotional, mental, like, illness, just like we would with if we have, like, the flu or something like that, right? So don't get too caught up on, like, the terms or, like, oh, I don't want to be labeled that. We don't want to label people, right? It's just like, hey, this is just we're having a conversation, and we'll go over, I think it's maybe the next slide. Yeah, so pretty much what we do, I'm going to skip those. So pretty much when we make a mental health diagnosis, right, it's just for, it's you just think about how, like, doctors and nurses and people in the physical health field, right, they have to really kind of diagnose you with, like, oh, you have the flu or you have pneumonia, I'm going to give you an antibiotic, right? So they have to diagnose you with something in order for them to kind of treat you with that. And if they know, okay, if this person has pneumonia, these are the signs and symptoms of someone who has pneumonia. And if we know, if they meet those signs, oh, they have pneumonia and this is how I treat them. And these are some medications that would go with that, like physical health diagnosis. So it's very similar in that we as counselors have what we call mental health diagnoses, and we have a book, the DSM-5, that kind of says, hey, these are the different mental health diagnoses. These are the signs and symptoms. So if you see someone, this is just what they're struggling with. And then you can say, okay, how do I then begin to look for treatment for this individual with like this diagnosis? So again, it's not something that we necessarily want to like we don't want to label people, right? We're just using it as just as a reference for us as professionals in order to treat people well. So the doctor, right, he works with physical, a therapist or a counselor. We work with mental, emotional, and behavioral parts of ourselves. They can all be related, right? We just know we're very, like, holistic. Our physical can affect our mental and emotional, and our mental and emotional can affect our physical. So we're just all very interconnected. So depression, right, is just, I'm sure you guys are somewhat aware of some of these things, but these are just some things that we look for. If you're feeling sad or having a depressed mood, if there's a loss of interest or pleasure in activity. So this, again, would be like, hey, usually I really enjoy going out and playing basketball with my buddies or going out to coffee with some girlfriends, but I just do not feel like it. I am really down, depressed, and I don't want to go out. Or even just like if there's things at home, like if I like to draw or if I like to, you know, do something at home or bake or cook or whatever, and I no longer feel any motivation to do anything. Those are some things that we look for. Changes in appetite, right? If we're feeling really depressed or anxious, our appetite usually changes, right? Usually we don't want to eat or we're with loss of appetite, right? We're just not feeling hungry. I don't feel like eating. Or on the opposite side, maybe we might eat more as a way to kind of self-soothe or to feel better, or we don't know what else to do, so we just keep eating. Or we just, like, the meal times are more significant for us. And with trouble sleeping. So we struggle to fall asleep, or maybe usually with depression, you're actually sleeping a lot more. Sometimes it's the opposite, but usually we're sleeping a lot more. Just feeling like fatigued and just exhausted all the time, right? Because our mental and emotional takes a lot of energy from us. And so we're just feeling exhausted a lot. So there's a few different things there. Difficulty concentrating, making decisions, feeling worthless, guilty, sense of shame. A lot of times there, like we were saying, there's some deep, usually core beliefs that we're beginning to think about ourselves or the world or a situation that we're really feeling depressed about. And so we begin to maybe have feelings of guilty, of being guilty, sense of shame. And it is frequent that sometimes maybe we might say, oh, I just wish I would die, all this would be over. Or I don't want to be a burden to my friends or family or different things. Maybe it would be better if I'm not here. Just having thoughts of like, man, if maybe, like, it's usually an escape, right? And we don't want to really put a burden, or we don't, like, just life doesn't seem to be worth living anymore. And so that's where the thoughts of maybe suicide come in, where we begin to have those. Mike was encouraged me. So with suicide, usually there's like different degrees that we kind of look at with suicide. So usually there's, you might have, desire, I think is first. Maybe we might have a little bit of a desire. We might have a thought about it. And then there, so that we kind of look for varying degrees. So you might have a desire for something, and then there's intent, right? Where it's a little bit more significant, where like maybe I am actually more intentional or intentionally thinking about it, or it's on my mind, or I might have intent to possibly, you know, do something or create a plan to do something to harm myself. And then there's like, what's the last one again? Where we're just like, we have a plan in place and we're actually like maybe having like significant urges to do that. So there's just some things that we look at as a therapist to like, hey, like, where are they? How intentional or unintentional are they? And significant is this plan? And if there's anything related or close to a plan, then we really like, all right, we have to be making sure that we're monitoring them and that friends and family and other people are around, or maybe we need to send them to a hospital where maybe they would get some inpatient help, where people would be monitoring them 24/7 in a facility.
And recognize that you don't have to be a therapist to take someone at their word or the hospital. I mean, I think all of us have had these thoughts or fleeting thoughts where it's like, man, I would be better if I wasn't here or whatever. And then we're like, oh my word, what am I thinking, right? But when someone has an intent where it's like, man, if this is what I would do, or they say, no, this is what I'm going to do, we don't mess around with that at all. And I would say any of us, if we hear those things, get them to the hospital, call the police, whatever you need to do. There have been, I know in some teenage relationships that I've seen, or even young adult, if you leave me, I'm going to kill myself, right? And then it's almost a manipulation tactic. I tell the other partner of that relationship, call the police. Don't mess around with that. If they're saying stuff like that, you take them at their word, because you would never want to be wrong, right?
So if they need help immediately, you could call the local crisis number. They can kind of walk you through, like, hey, yes, they do need to go, or they can give some guidance as to what to do in some kind of situation like that. So whether someone is expressing some suicide, or maybe they are having a behavioral issue. So crisis intervention is kind of a great place to kind of just call and be like, hey, this is what's going on. And they can help give direction, kind of help maybe calm the situation down. But yes, if someone is actively like, hey, like, I am planning to go take some pills at like 5 o'clock, or as soon as I leave here, or, you know, leave, whatever, obviously, yes, we would then say, hey, you know what, like, can you go with me to the ER? And they'll do an assessment at the ER. They'll assess for suicide, and then they'll put them in the inpatient unit of the hospital. So typically we would encourage people to like, hey, if you know them, especially if they're a friend or a family member or someone that you know, encourage them to be like, hey, I'm with you. I really care about you. And I like am so worried for your safety. I really can't leave you alone right now. Can you please go with me? Can we go together to the hospital and get the help that you need and the support that you need? So we encourage people to go to the hospital with them, just sit and be there with them while they get assessed and then decided what happens. So if they don't go with you, then we encourage people to like, hey, maybe you do need to call either the ambulance or the police. I know that usually we're like, the police? Like, that sounds really, like, really big. But really the police come out and they just kind of say like, hey, they kind of do kind of a little bit of their own assessment. And then if they're like, yes, this person really is a harm to themselves or a danger to themselves, they will then have to be like, hey, either I'm going to have to use some force, like I'm going to involuntarily take you to the hospital, or you're going to go to yourself. So the police is just kind of a little bit of like, hey, if they're unwilling to, sometimes they just kind of give a little bit of that authority of like, hey, you actually do need to go to the hospital. Do you want me to, like, I'm going to have to take you. You're going to have to go. Do you want me to do it, or do you want to go voluntarily? So just it just gives a little bit of support for that. Good question. Any other questions on that? Okay. Yeah, I mean, obviously suicide is really scary, and also it is very serious, and yeah, so we don't want to take it lightly. Yeah, so you can go ahead and play that clip. This is just a little clip of like someone who's really depressed. We used the Winnie the Pooh characters to kind of describe some different mental health feelings and people.
Just my luck, a heffalump, leering at his lunch.
Eeyore, I'm not a heffalump.
Doesn't matter anyway. Headed for the waterfall. I'll be gone soon.
Oh no, not the waterfall. Swim!
Not that anyone will notice.
Swim, swim, swim!
Just have to go with the flow.
Don't worry.
I'm not. Can't change the inevitable.
Mustn't give up, Eeyore. I'll save you.
We'll see.
Oh, yes, of course. I've grown up, haven't I? Oh, Eeyore!
Laughing at my misfortune, just like a heffalump.
Hello, Eeyore.
Hello, heffalump.
Not a heffalump. I'm Christopher Robin. Do you remember I used to try and cheer you up?
I don't remember being cheery.
So, as you can see, sometimes it is really difficult. I don't know if you've had experienced friends or had some of that experience where sometimes when you're so depressed or down, it is really hard to think of a time when you were even cheery or that life was better. And it is really hard to like even just, you know, get to even receive encouragement from someone else or to be like, just swim or do this or like, you can do it. You can sit, you know, it is really hard kind of to receive that. So I would say that's a pretty hard case of Eeyore was struggling with a very hard case of depression, but we just thought that was a cute depiction of sometimes what people go through. So the next is Little Piglet, who, if you've ever seen Winnie the Pooh, right, just very anxious all the time, sometimes like shaking with anxiety. So usually we have excessive worry and anxiety and apprehension about different things in our life, or sometimes social anxiety, or just fears with the future, or even just specific things in our life. So you can just read over some of those. Those are just very common and distinct things that we have. I think pretty much with anxiety, what we really go over is God created us with a fight, flight, or freeze response. So the first response, right, is fight. So if I'm feeling any kind of danger or tension or feeling attacked, whether it's in our heads or it's actually perceived or maybe it's verbally or physically, right, if we're feeling any kind of that sense of feeling like attacked or defense or that there's danger involved, right? Our body, God designed our body to respond to it, right? In order to survive and actually to protect ourselves. So it's incredibly amazing. I just am amazed almost every day at just like how God designed our brains and our bodies in order to survive and to protect ourselves, whether from physical or emotional or mental like danger. And so our gut response is first maybe to fight. So maybe we might actually get aggressive, or maybe we might get really angry, or maybe we might actually like really lash out at someone in order to, because we're feeling like we're anxious inside and we're anxious about something happening or something being taken away or whatever. So we might feel really anxious or angry, right? And we have that fight response might come out. Anxiety oftentimes is, so there can be some fight involved, but anxiety usually is that flight and freeze response. So flight, right, is just we just want to run the opposite direction. We just want to disappear. We want to sink into the ground. There's just a lot of like, I need to get out of this situation because I'm feeling so on edge and I'm feeling like I just can't handle it. I'm really worried and concerned about something happening. So usually that flight response comes out, and then freeze, right, is just where you just literally just freeze and just wish it just blows over and maybe this will eventually pass and I'll be okay. So with anxiety, it's a lot of that flight response, and our body physically responds as if there is even like a physical danger in the room. So my adrenaline's going to start pumping. My heart's going to start beating faster, right? The blood is going to go to my extremities or to different places in order for me to like actually run or fight or do something physical to get away from the danger or whatever perceived threat that we are experiencing. We might also feel a little nauseous because, right, the blood is going away from our digestion, and it's like our adrenaline is pumping, our mind is racing, and our brains are designed to just react. We're not thinking about logic. We're not thinking about anything reasonable. That part of our brain literally goes like offline because in really like high intense danger situations, right, we can't react we can't think, because if we don't just react, then it could be our lives or someone else's life, right? So that's where like our body is so intricately, God designed our body for survival, that our brain then with anxiety thinks, oh my gosh, there's something wrong, there's danger. But it's in our minds and it's our perceived threat or danger that our body is reacting to and is getting ready to fight, flight, or freeze. But it doesn't, our brain and our emotions don't know that, like, actually, I'm okay. I'm safe. I don't need to fight. I don't need to run the other direction. I don't need to just react. I really am okay. So really what I encourage people to really understand is just it's our brain and our emotions and our body getting into that fight, flight, or freeze response. And we just, it's, our brain hasn't really determined that, right? Because past experiences have taught me this is going to be harmful. I'm either going to get really hurt, I'm going to be rejected, or I'm going to, like, something really bad is going to happen, or I'm not going to be able to handle this. And so our emotions tell us that, right? And experience has maybe taught us, or I've been encouraging these thoughts or beliefs. So that's just a little bit about anxiety. It's just God gave us that response. It's just our brain and the alarm system is getting a little bit, it's not distinguishing between maybe a real threat or a perceived threat that we are believing. Any questions on that? Okay. Mike, did you want to say anything on anxiety?
And you probably have heard this word a lot because it's become more as trauma. A lot of we hear this word more and more now because more science and more evidence is being shown that trauma is stored within the body because the brain can't handle or it places it in the body because it's too much. And what happens with trauma is it gets kind of stuck in the brain. When you sleep at night, you may not know this, but we have REM sleep, a REM cycle, right? And your eyes underneath your eyelids are doing this. And it's your brain's literally uses your eyes to process downloading the information of the day. When trauma happens, it kind of gets stuck in a frozen state. And a lot of people will relive that over and over and over again, and certain things will trigger a trauma response. So that's a little different than anxiety. It is something they live with on a daily basis. There was a man who was in, I believe it was Afghanistan, And he was in one Humvee, and the Humvee in front of him with his other platoon of, you know, his other guys from his platoon, there was a parked car that they had pulled up to, and the parked car blew up and killed everybody in the Humvee right in front of him. When he went back to the States, every time he would see a parked car in front of his house, he would have a trauma response. And so he ended up seeing a therapist that does eye movement desensitization reprocessing, which allowed him to kind of reprocess the traumatic event, which allowed him now to be able to see the car as non-threat. But that's intensive therapy, but very good therapy. But bottom line is, when there's a trauma, it's not something that they can just get over with a medication, or they can get over just by thinking something differently. They have to work through that trauma and that pain.
Yeah, so a lot of times we have what we call little T's, little traumas, or just little things that were wounding to us that maybe add up to where we do need to have maybe some therapy to work through some things that, again, like encouragement, or we can't just handle on our own or through the Bible, through prayer, different things. Not that those things aren't good and really helpful, but sometimes we do need someone to kind of work through some of those little T's or big T's, right? That would be a big T of experiencing, you know, the Humvee in front of you with your buddies blow up. So, yeah. This is obsessive compulsive disorder. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on here. But this is just a specific type of anxiety diagnosis, right? Where we're having obsessive thoughts about something in particular, and we have these compulsions that we need to do something, usually in a ritual or in a specific order, in order to calm that anxiety. So maybe I need to turn the light switch off three times before leaving the room, and then I know that things are going to be okay. So things like that, or washing hands, or a certain number of time, or maybe having a ritual for what I need to do, like for shower and hygiene and different things.
We all have a tendency for this a little bit. How many of you leave the house and go, oh shoot, did I turn my curling iron off? Right? My wife, I just heard her last Sunday. We were leaving, and I heard her yell up the stairs, Michael, is my curling iron off? Right? Or is the oven off? Did I close the garage door? The problem is with OCD is it gets to the extreme. Yeah, of course, if you don't have hair, we don't have to worry about that, right? Amen. That's another reason why bald is good. It's when it becomes obsessive, when it starts, you're taking time out of your day, it's basically you're late for work, these other things are really inhibiting you to do daily things, then it becomes a problem. Yeah.
And it's also usually extremely difficult for family members as well to live with. ADHD, you guys are probably familiar with this just among children and teens, and this is also among adults as well. So I'm just going to skip through that. Tigger would be an example of ADHD, right? He just was bouncing around all the time. bipolar disorder, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this either, but this is just where someone may have a really high, very energetic, they're not sleeping for days, they're doing some maybe risky behavior, they're having a really strong sense of self, of I'm amazing, I can do anything, and I'm really smart, and I can do all these things. So they may have a manic or hypomanic episode. This would be for a few days or a few weeks at a time. And then they might have a really deep depressive episode where they would last for at least 2 weeks. So that's a little bit with bipolar disorder. So this isn't where one moment you're really happy and then one moment you're really depressed. That's something else. That's not bipolar. addiction. So obviously, if we're thinking about like, hey, if someone is really struggling with anxiety, depression, or just mental health, or things in general, right? Sometimes there's a lot of substances out there, or a lot of things that we can do to try to deal with our mental health, or self-soothe, or to feel better, that in the short term maybe may help a little bit, but in the long term, right, it's not helping your mental health. It actually makes it worse, right? Whether it's marijuana or smoking or video games, being on our phones, just a lot of different things, pornography, masturbation, any kind of those things for men and women. So I just wanted to go over some different types of therapy. These are just, again, some different levels of what we call care, right? Some are less intensive, some are more intensive. Residential would be like the highest form of like care, right? Where they actually go and live somewhere for a time to get the care that they need. So residential would be the highest. And then obviously inpatient, right? They're just, maybe they're in there for 72 hours, or maybe they're in there for a week or two, sometimes three. It just kind of depends, right? And right, all of this is just to really help stabilize them and get them on the right track. And then they'll refer them down to like a lower level of care. So sometimes if someone goes into inpatient at the hospital, maybe they'll be there for like 2 weeks, and then they'll be recommended to go to partial, which is it's a step down. So partial is where you would go to from like 8:30 to like 2:30 or something like that, right? So it's like you're there for the day, maybe like every day of the week, maybe at first, or maybe it's just 3 days a week that you go. So again, it's just having some, like they do group, they do individual, and they just monitor and make sure you're taking your medication and different things. So so really it's just different levels. So that's partial hospitalization. Then there's outpatient therapies, which is what we do, right? We work in an office. People come to see us at their office, and then they go home. And then there's mobile therapies. This could be family therapy, where the therapist comes out to the home and they do family therapy. It could be where they work with a child or a teen. So there's a whole bunch of different types. They can go out to the school. So there's a whole bunch of different mobile therapists, actually. And then there's different kinds of therapy, right? We can do individual, we do group, we can do family, we can do couples, and then there's specialized therapies, a whole bunch of different theories or approaches to help heal someone. Theories, right? There's just a whole bunch of theories. The theories just keep growing. They're just there. I'm not going to go over all of these, but pretty much what we do is we just look. Mike and I are both trained in EMDR therapy, which is what he was saying for trauma. And that is just one for specific kind of therapy. But really what a lot of our therapists do is we really integrate a lot of different therapies and approaches and techniques to really say, hey, each individual is different. What they need is different. How can I use my knowledge and experience from different theories or approaches to help them individually the best that we can? So psychologists, sometimes I like to go over these. Psychologist is a doctor, like he was saying. Not a real doctor. He is actually a real doctor, right? So psychologists, right, they have had a lot of training in psychology and assessments and assessing, like doing psychological evaluations or different psychological assessments. So they have their doctorate. They may do a lot of assessments, and they can also do therapy. So they have their doctorate. They can do both. Psychiatrists, they're very similar in that, like, the word. People get confused with these. Psychiatrists are actually more like a medical doctor, but like a doc, like they prescribe medication. So their focus is on medication and how do we treat like the mental and physical parts of someone. So they're actually able to prescribe medication. So if someone wants a medication, they would be looking for a psychiatrist. And then we have licensed and non-licensed therapists. So I have my license like through the state. Mike is working on his to get licensed. So that is a few year process, at least 2.5 years in order to get your license as a counselor. Anyway, so there's a whole bunch of different counselors here that you can go over and if you have any questions about those. I'm gonna go sit here for a little bit. So when are we done? In like 5 minutes? A couple minutes, yeah, okay. So I just want to encourage you, like we were kind of saying before, God created us with emotions, with mood, with a mind, right? He created us with that fight, flight, or freeze. And he created us to be in community with people, right? And when we're in a family or in a community, right, there's always going to be things that are coming up that we're going to be experiencing, some hurts or wounds, and also some joys and really awesome memories and experiences too, right? So we have everything that we're going through, right? And as we go through life with family and friends and in community, we're going to have those highs and we're going to those really positive experiences. We're going to have some negative experiences too. So what we look for is like, hey, how can we as counselors really help people work through and heal from their any negative experiences so that they can fully enjoy and thrive and have really good cognitive beliefs about themselves and the world and work through some of those emotions as well so that they can live a life where like we are thriving and we are excited about life and community and friends and God, right? And doing his work. So I don't think, and there's different people in the Bible that have struggled with mental health. So we just listed a few up there. You know, Job, we can understand why he was really depressed for a time. He was really depressed for a time, right? But we can also understand, like, hey, like, it's okay to experience times when, like, maybe we're struggling. And we even see Jesus, when he even struggled, like he was struggling with his own emotions before he went on the cross. He was also feeling really down, right? Like he spent hours in the garden saying, God, is there any way that we can take this away, please? And he was feeling really, like he had a lot of emotions that he was working through. And he wasn't, like it was really difficult for him to go to the cross. So, yeah, so we see all these different characters in the Bible. Even Elijah, I think that's also a good indication, right, of just like, hey, it doesn't mean that you don't, that you aren't a Christian. It doesn't mean that you don't have enough faith. Maybe it doesn't mean that you need to pray more or read the Bible or different things, right? Or it makes you a bad person. It just means that we're human. And that God is there, right? He promises to never leave us or forsake us. And he promises like, hey, I'm going to be with you through this, even if you're going through a hard time. So what we counselors do is we like to really say like, hey, how can we, can you partner with us to help you walk through on this journey of healing? And God's going to be there with you too. All right. Anyway, thanks for letting us share. We'll be around afterwards if you have any questions.